There we go.
Okay, good morning, Sangha. It's good to see everyone. Apologize for the technical difficulties, but here we are, like Deborah said, right when we're supposed to be, I guess. So, this is an interesting time, an interesting subject that we're moving into. But you know, first we're going to sit. But for those of you who don't know me, my name's Greg Pergament. I've been working with Kevin for 12 years or so now. Started at Vajrapani, teaching a little bit of Qigong at his retreats. And then we became really good friends and my Dharma evolved and I started leading groups here in Las Vegas. Really because there was no other Buddhism and recovery groups here in Las Vegas. So my wife grew weary of me saying, I wish there was a Buddhism recovery group. I wish there was a Buddhism. She goes, why don't you just start one? I said, who, me? And she goes, if not you, who? And it felt like that John Kennedy thing, right? So I said, okay, I'll do that, you know, and I got some of Kevin's stuff and peer-led groups, and it just, there were no peers, so I evolved into a facilitator. And it's been a growth process for me that's been incomparable, you know, just being able to come and to help people to, like, open that little Dharma door to people that really had, a lot of them had no experience at all with Buddhism. Some recovery, and it's been going on now for about 12 years. No, yeah, about 12 years now on a weekly basis. So when Kevin started bringing me on retreats, and then he would let me lead metta, and then now, you know, he lets me lead a fair amount and become like a co-teacher. So for him to invite me to sit in for him is a big honor for me. You know, although we're very close friends and we can kid around and stuff, I know that he takes the presentation of the Dharma and these teachings very seriously, and as do I, as comical and joyful as my practice and my presentations usually are, there's an underlying tone of the value, how precious it is to, you know, turn people on to the Dharma. Because the Buddha said, you know, some people go their whole lives and never hear one word of Dharma. And here we're like inundated with it in our lives. So I thought we'd sit. I'm told that's what you usually do first. And then I'll talk a little bit about a very interesting subject that I don't want to tell you about now, so you won't have a lot of mental proliferation about it. But just know that I will be talking about some aspect of Dharma and recovery. So I'll ring the bell once to start. This will be fairly guided. And then three times on the other side to transition out. So the invitation is to let the sound of that bell bring you, your mind, body, heart, into the present moment, into a posture of your choosing. It is often recommended that that posture be upright. The body aligned in a way that stillness is enhanced, yet an ease in the body. I like to think of settling into the posture as arriving. And we all know how to arrive. Maybe we've had a difficult day and we get into our living space and there's a favorite chair or and we settle into it, and we have that sense of arriving someplace we want to be. Or we're meeting someone, a close friend, a dear friend, and we get in their presence and we just kind of settle into that space. I think it's somewhat important for us to feel that when we sit down, no matter how many times we've returned to this posture to sit quietly and feel. Eyes gently closed, usually as suggested. If you feel safe, presumably we're all in our living spaces in this Zoom time, so my hope is that you feel safe where you are. And let the body settle into this moment. And as we sit here in this stillness, I like to say relative stillness because there's always a little bit of movement because the body has to breathe. Air will enter and exit the body of its own volition. So we can feel that. And that can be our anchor of sorts to the present moment. As we all know, the mind often has a mind of its own. So we have to remind the mind of our intention. Present, to connect with life. To be receptive. And to let go. Sense of curiosity or interest on what's going to unfold. We don't know. We think we know. The conditions for awakening are present. Stillness, silence, not quite yet. I'm still talking, but soon. And presence, receptive, non-judgmental presence. And lastly, we bring a element of kindness to this process. One could even say love, but at least kindness. So no matter what shows up, thoughts drift to the past or the future, and we realize that, we wake up to that. We remember to be kind, and gently, compassionately redirect back to the present moment. Sense doors open. So awake, so alert in this moment that nothing could come in contact with the sense doors that we would miss. Sight's a little diminished if your eyes are closed, but it's amazing how much you can see with the eyes closed. sense, feel with the eyes closed. So we open to that. We open to that possibility. Just like that. What's the condition of the heart mind right now? In a couple of minutes, the bell will ring. And I'd like to invite everyone to kind of blur that distinction between whatever has been cultivated here in this moment and what happens when we open the eyes. So that would involve stillness, just opening the eyes and seeing if we can maintain that mindfulness with the eyes open. All right. Well, again, welcome to some of the people that have arrived after I welcomed other people. My name is Greg Pergamit. I teach with Kevin on retreat. Teach a little bit here in Las Vegas, mostly on Zoom right now. You know, when I was introducing myself, I left out a very important part of, you know, who this thing is. And, you know, I am a person in long-term recovery. I have 33 years in recovery. So, you know, and it's interesting that I didn't mention that because, you know, not using and being in a path, I've become so comfortable with it. It's not so jarring anymore. Like, you know, still 33 sounds a little weird. Like, oh my, that's a really long time, right? But, and that's really a result of, well, the program, my recovery program in general is Narcotics Anonymous. But really when I synthesized it with Buddhism and started to enhance, because I saw the parallels, but I really, you know, was content to keep them like railroad tracks. Here's my Dharma, here's my recovery. But they started to mesh and I started to see them and all these coincidences and correlations were showing up. But when that happened, there was like no looking back. There really wasn't. And the idea that in Buddhism is particularly Theravadan Buddhism, where they have the fifth precept that asks us or asks you if you want freedom to refrain from that which clouds the mind and leads to heedlessness. I'm like, oh man, that's, you know, that just like, it's like scaffolding, you know, holding up this determination to be abstinent in my life. So it's been really cool. So Kevin and I, we have this, sometimes he'll ask me, like when we're on retreat or we're driving to retreat, you know, what he's going to talk about. He doesn't do it so much anymore, but he used to. And I would always say, God. And he says, you always say that. I said, that's what people want to hear. That's why they come to this, you know, lots of times. I said, plus it's so interesting. Like, how do we do that? How do we take this, if it's a 12-step recovery as your path, how do we take this language that you know, we're not deluded. We can see that it's leading kind of towards this intervention as God of sorts. And how do we use that if that's not where our belief system lies? Or how does Buddhism relate to that? It's a very interesting subject. So when we were talking on one of our, before he asked me to do this, I had just picked up a hard copy of The Inquiring Mind. Many of you might be familiar with that magazine. It's a wonderful magazine. Well, they don't print it anymore, but it's all archived online. But the copy that I had picked up was old and the corners were, you know, it's half ripped and everything. It was in the bottom of a bag and it was The God Issue, right? And so I pulled that out and I started, and I was reading it. So then when Kevin said that he was going to be doing going through the book, Burning Desire, here with all of you, he said, oh, that's perfect then, right? So I said, cool, well, I'll talk about God then. So I wanted to bring it, you know, I could talk for, you know, a long time about Kevin's work. And in my groups here in Las Vegas, I do that. I reference him all the time because he's done such introspective and type work in that area, you know, about like with God and Buddhism and how they inform each other. But I didn't want to do that because he's going to be doing that. So I thought what I'd do is talk for a little bit about my path with how it's happened for me with God, and then a little bit of what I discovered in that magazine, The God Issue. So I'll go way back to 6 months before. I don't even count this meeting that I went to, because I was trying to keep my job and I had gotten caught using on the job, and so when I went to the meeting, I was under the influence and I had a bottle of vodka in my pocket, a trench coat. So then when they mentioned all the preambles in Narcotics Anonymous, they mentioned alcohol as a drug, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh man, I can't, like, not this too, right? So I sat in that meeting horrified that someone was gonna hear it and they were gonna circle up and spill it out, and then I would be in it probably fighting. So I just sat there like stiff as a board, and the meeting was over. I left and I went home to my wife, and she asked me how it was. I said, it's a little too religious for me, you know? And that was it. 6 months later, begging for relief. That's how quickly it was already devolving, you know, my addiction, but it had really just fallen to pieces 6 months later. And so much so that that suicide was the viable alternative that was in my mind. It was suicide or let me try this thing that my stepsister's doing. So when I came into Narcotics Anonymous, I had the idea of a God, but I was mad. You know what I mean? It was like I kind of thought that there was something more than just this, but I was so angry that I wouldn't even say the word, right? And they would try and trick me. You know, they would give me readings that had that word in it. And when I got to that word, I would say blank. And they were like, ah, and they were like slap their thighs and whatever. So one time I was talking to a wiser person than myself, my sponsor, and he said, what's up with you in that word? It's just a word to describe what you're already experiencing. And I'm like, really? He goes, yeah, it's just three little letters. And so I decided to use that word. And I start, and the first time I said it, the whole room erupted in applause. And it was like, I was saved or whatever the case might be. So that was okay for a while, you know, and I would use it for, you know, all sorts of things, you know, and getting things I wanted, you know, and sometimes most of the time it worked out, you know, if it was in line. But we really had a falling out, this interventionist God in me, when it came to step 6 and 7. I know the step talks about the actions that we're supposed to take, but the clear wording of those two steps with our defects of character implies that something's going to remove them. And nothing was getting removed. Absolutely nothing. So instead of just throwing the baby out with the bathwater, I just kind of changed the way I was praying, of sorts. So I no longer was asking for things. It started just thanking. No matter what was going on in my life, I was thanking these powers, if you will. And I got to this point where, and I read this quote actually, and it was from a rabbi. And the rabbi had this quote, and he said, prayer is his humble answer to the inconceivable surprise of living. And I thought, whoa, that's true for me, right? I am utterly surprised that I'm still alive, even now, even more so, but then, right? So that's kind of where my path went. And then so with this less reliance on something to intervene and correct my behavior and all this other, you know, magical type stuff, it kind of put me in a mindset of being aware of harm that I was causing, right? And starting to align myself with harmless behavior to the best of my ability at any given time. And so that kind of was a natural integration into Dharma, because that's what Dharma is, you know? Cultivating that which is wholesome and abandoning that which is not. It's a life's work figuring that out, but that's really the way I see it, Buddhism in a nutshell. So, and then as you know, my recovery progressed and I moved to Las Vegas and whatnot, I started to get involved with Native American practices, sweat lodges, vision quest, even went to Sundance a couple times in the Lakota tradition. And they have this idea of a spirit that moves in all things, like an energy, right? So I said, oh yeah, that seems right. Like I don't, you know, how could this happen? How can this leaf give off oxygen? You know, it's like, it's incredible. So just nature itself and the energy and the spirit that moves through all this and the seasons changing and all of it, it just made sense to me. And Kevin mentions that in the introduction to his book about, you know, coming up with names for his God at the time. And he settled on Great Spirit, which is from the native traditions. So even in that tradition, there's a fair amount of petitioning that goes on, but I don't really do that a lot. You know, it's more of a gratitude, a thanking, you know, like, wow, no matter what goes on, you know, been through some, you know, survived some really tragic things in my recovery, you know, and still there was an ability to find some gratitude within that process. As hard as it was sometimes. The latest was our daughter, my stepdaughter, passed away in May. And, you know, I'm like, what do I do with this? You know, because we want to find something, some place that they're going to go to and, you know, and we can meet with them again. And I just let go of all that. And it just became like, how can I be there for her now in this moment as an authentic human being? Not this needy person that wants things to be different than they are. So that's where I'm at pretty much these days with my God. And so there was a couple of things. I do want to mention one thing from Kevin's book because it's so interesting. It's an Ajahn Amaro, many of you familiar with him. And he's an Englishman and a Theravadan monk. And he was ordained by Ajahn Chah. So he's very lucid and charming, and he's a great example of wisdom and serenity in Buddhism and of the teachings. So he was at this monastery, and a grandmother who had never been to a meditation center before asked Ajahn Amaro, is there a God in Buddhism? And even and Kevin was present for this, and he felt this tension. He's like, so he felt the anxiety. And then Ajahn Amaro said with a smile, Buddhism is all about God. And it just like shocked him, you know. But it's not the conventional understanding of God, the God idea, right? So there's a lot of traditions that use the word or different variations of that word. And the problem that Kevin saw and he talks about in his book and that Buddhadasa Bhikkhu talks about, and he even I guess I am going to use Kevin's work. I can't not, right? So he says, as long as people insist that God is a person in the conventional sense of people language, we can say that we will not know the real God. Buddhadasa Bhikkhu talked a lot about a lot about God, right? So we have this idea of Dharma, you know, and hence Dharma God, and how that would work in our life. Karma, you know, the unfolding of intention through karma, right? So in this article, and then I'll open this up, I just want to talk a little bit about this. It's kind of funny. Wes Nisker, many of you might be familiar with his work as well. He's very funny, right? So in this issue of the God issue, he had an article that he wrote called That Old Time Religion, right? And he had two quotes at the top before he started. And the first quote is, God is so perfect, he doesn't have to exist. And that was an anonymous quote, right? And then he had one by George Bernard Shaw that says, all great truths begin as blasphemies. So two very interesting ways. So he talks about this, and he talks about, you know, the different traditions of God-based theistic religions. And then he comes up with a solution. And I think what the problem for me in the recovery thing, it wasn't so much, you know, we have this idea where we're given full reign to create a God of our understanding, one that resonates with us. My problem, and for lots of people, I think, is we don't know what we want, but we know what we don't want, right? So it's like, how does that, you know, how does that happen? So we have to, you know, that's why I gravitated into using some of the other things that I had heard, because personally, in my own life experience, I wasn't, you know, I didn't know what I wanted. I knew what I didn't want. So he talks about the name. Sometimes it's with the word, like it was for me, not saying that, right? And he says, why should anybody care if someone uses a different name for God? He can't imagine any deity saying with menace, hey, buddy, what did you call me? Or you should bother, or why should you be bothered if someone calls their God Omega or Felix, or doesn't use the word at all? You know, in the Jewish religion, they don't mention it really. They don't write it especially. He said there's a chance that God doesn't even have a name. There's even a good chance that God isn't a being, right? Or at least not some human-like being. He's funny, right? So he says, do you think we are all so good looking that a God who could look like anything or nothing would actually want to look like us? And yet he would guess that he's talking to us now, most of us reading this will have a certain picture of God, an image that you grew up with. And then he talks about Judaism, which has you know, not supposed to make any graven images because God is everywhere and has no particular form. That's very similar, right, to the Native American spirit in all things, right? And that was the great leap of spiritual imagination that also saved, he said, it saved the Jews a lot of money on statues. Like I said, he's funny. He has a modest suggestion on how we can deal with humanity's lingering problems about God. First of all, we can call all the gods together for a summit. Maybe this meeting could be on Mount Olympus or somewhere in the Himalayas, where there are already lots of gods around who could host a gathering. And once we got all the gods together, we would beseech them. Buddhadasa Bhikkhu uses that word a lot, beseeching the law of karma. All of us beseeching our own particular deity to do humanity a great big favor and decide on a common name. Since Wes Nisker is the only person working on this project, he will take the liberty to propose a new name for God. He notices that a lot of the names for God already, Jehovah, Allah, Brahma, Tara, Diana, Krishna, and in the common nickname of Ah, right? So it's a perfect name. Ah is the first sound that most of us make when we are born, and it's the last sound we make as we die, crying or sighing, Ah. So he thinks this would be a good name for God. Another possibility is to give our highest deity the name Ma, which is the same word in almost all human languages referring to mother. Then as we pray, instead of looking upward towards our Father who art in heaven, we would look down to the earth, the womb of all life. And he said, there's another Ah for you. Maybe we could include both names, Ah and Ma. We could divide God into two, male and female. Interesting, right? Mother and father, yin and yang, earth and sky, sun and moon, Ama or Ma'a. And then he talks about the possibilities for songs and praises are infinite. Ama, I think there's a word, that word's ringing like has a recognition in my mind that I think it's a word for grandmother in some language, I'm not sure. But Ama, it sounds like something I've heard before. So the idea is not so much what God is, it's how we're interpreting that word, in reference to what we believe. And being willing and open to the fact that it may evolve. Sometimes we're afraid of it, right? We're afraid of that evolution of a belief system. Maybe it's not what we believe, you know. And in the steps, it talks about a God as we understand him. When does that happen? Is there an end result to understanding that? Understanding something as profound as a God or godliness, right? Or Dharma, right? It's a never-ending process. I will never understand it. I'm understanding it. It's like it's an ongoing thing. It's very flux and fluid, like all things, like all phenomena. So that's about it for I think, and I'll open this up. Ama, there it is. Somebody put it in chat. For God, and then I'll leave the rest to Kevin when he gets back from retreat. And he might have a lot to say, or he might be nothing. He might let it all go. You know, we come off retreat, we have these ideas, like I know that for me, it's sometimes words are insufficient to describe experience. So I'd like to open it up and see if anybody has any comments or questions, anything along those lines. I guess we can stop the recording now so people feel safe that way, if that's okay, Monica or Ange. As interesting as your questions usually are,